This is SciPod, the podcast of New Scientist magazine.
Welcome to SciPod, your audio guide to the latest and most intriguing stories in science and technology, as gathered and reported by the staff of New Scientist magazine. Hello, I'm Bill Oxley. This week on the May 5th edition of SciPod, Through the Mind's Eye, how the technology of medical imaging can allow researchers to see what you're thinking. London Calling, how the race to bring the telephone to Britain led to one of the most unusual inventions in the history of communication. And how much wood would a gorilla eat if a gorilla could eat wood? Quite a lot, as it turns out, and there's plenty more to chew on in this week's science news. But first, what does a thought look like? Not long ago, that question didn't make much sense. But these days, thanks to the development of functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, it's possible to peer at the human brain while it's at work and literally see thoughts taking shape. Frank Tong is one of the researchers at the forefront of this revolution. He's a cognitive neuroscientist who specializes in visual perception. And as New Scientist Ivan Semenek discovered, he's been learning to see through the mind's eye.
Dr. Tong, your work focuses on a question that in traditional philosophy is often referred to as the mind-body problem. Can you remind us what that problem is and what it means from a neuroscience perspective?
Sure. The mind-body problem was brought up by Descartes, and he asked the question, how is it that the mental and material worlds, how are they united? And he proposed that they might be united through the pineal gland. Nowadays, modern neuroscientists know that the brain is a very complex system with lots of ongoing neural activity. And our problem is that of, can we understand what a person is thinking or experiencing by studying their neural activity? That is, what's the relationship between brain activity and thought?
So this is really about getting at the subjective part of the mind's eye, I suppose, especially when we're talking about perception. And that's been a black box for so long, going right back to Descartes and actually, you know, to Plato and beyond. So what is the new approach or the new technology that's finally letting you get into the black box of the human mind?
Well, a major advantage is that now we have ways to look into the black box using human brain imaging, specifically functional magnetic resonance imaging lets us take pictures of people's brain and map out their brain activity while they're performing various cognitive tasks. And we do something on top of that. We try to figure out, let's say if you're looking at an ambiguous image or you're presented with a question that you can think of in one way or another, we can let you either freely choose how to think about it or, let's say, pay attention to one of two possible interpretations and try to figure out how your brain reflects the conscious state that you're having, you know, independent of the specific stimulus being shown to you, if it's an ambiguous image, or the particular situation.
So I'm trying to picture this type of experiment. I'm imagining that I'm climbing into your MRI machine, and so you're getting essentially a live image of my brain and brain activity. What kind of images are you showing me, and what are you looking at as I'm looking at those images or dealing with those stimuli?
That's a good question. So we did two experiments. In the first experiment, I'd like to just describe it as a type of brain reading. We showed these different stripes of lines, sort of a set of stripes, and they could occur at different angles. And we'd ask the question, can we tell which set of stripes you're looking at, what angle of the stripes are, by looking at the patterns of activity in your brain? Now, that can be thought of as a type of brain reading because we can, you know, forego looking at the image you're looking at and try to figure out which image you're looking at just by studying your brain activity alone. But we could also do that just by looking over your shoulder.
Right.
In the case of the next experiment, we do something that's more like mind reading rather than brain reading. We look at the activity patterns in your brain when, let's say, you're looking at an ambiguous plaid stimulus. Now there are two sets of stripes, and you're allowed to freely choose which set of stripes you want to focus on, which ones you want to sort of pay attention to and really make salient in your mind's eye. And when you do that, we can look at your patterns of brain activity and try to guess what it is that's going on in your head, what you're focusing on.
So as we were saying earlier, you know, one of the big mysteries of human perception is what or where in our brains is that mechanism that creates our subjective experience of reality. I guess in a sense, the ghost in the machine. So what are these observations? What is this research telling you about how that works?
What seems to be happening is that the two orientations, the two stripes, are reaching your eye and reaching primary visual cortex. And presumably when the information first comes in, the signals are balanced. You get equally strong signals saying you're seeing one set of lines and the other. But when you focus your attention on just one set of lines, what your brain seems to be doing is sending these feedback signals from higher brain areas and biasing the activity in early areas like primary visual cortex. It's like the brain is trying to filter or pick out the signals that it wants and ignore the signals that it doesn't. And so as an entire network, the brain is highly active, and it goes back to the earliest stages to bias these signals. And one possibility of interpreting these data is that very early visual areas, including primary visual cortex, begin to reflect our conscious experiences. The entire brain in this way may be highly interconnected and all part of that representation, that experience of having that me looking at this picture feeling, that sort of little man in the head might not just be one little man, it might be this interconnectedness among many brain areas.
So when you talk about your success with being able to essentially peer into a subject's mind and get a sense of what they're attending to, it's impossible to escape the idea that all of this sounds very much like mind reading made real. I mean, you've used the word mind reading, so clearly it's a powerful investigative tool. But does it also raise concerns for you about whether we may someday, you know, lose the privacy of our very own thoughts because of techniques like this?
That's an important concern that I think scientists should all be aware of. And I think the possibility is there. I myself am skeptical about whether mind-reading tools will really be very effective, at least in their current form, at obtaining information against somebody's will. And I'll give you the following reason, at least for functional magnetic resonance imaging, why I think that might be the case.
Sure.
If you go back to the experiment with the plaid, where there are the two overlapping orientations, recall that we could read out which of the two orientations the person was paying attention to. But that choice was freely made by the subject. The subject could pick which of the two orientations they wanted to pay attention to, and we were able to read that out. Imagine another situation. You try to read somebody's mind and try to figure out what they're doing. They don't have to listen to you and follow your instructions. And if they don't, their activity will be biased towards whatever it is that they're really doing. And what we show is that depending on what mental state you choose to take on, you can bias activity throughout the entire brain, even the earliest visual areas of the brain, areas that are thought to be less malleable to cognitive influence. So I think that if a person really wants to keep his or her ideas private, they just don't have to think about the things that they're being asked to think about. And then the task of invading somebody's privacy would be pretty challenging, I think, because ultimately what we're trying to read out is what the person's thinking, and we don't have control over determining what the person is allowed to think or not.
Well, certainly you've given us some very interesting things to think about. Thanks very much for this, Dr. Tong.
Thank you.
Dr. Frank Tong spoke to us from his lab at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. You can find out more about his research in You Read My Mind, this week's edition of New Scientist magazine.
Because you're curious about the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
Now, from the London office of New Scientist, here's Caroline Williams with this week's science news.
Climate scientists have come up with a long-range forecast for planet Earth. If they're right, Europe and eastern North America are in for some stormy weather. The forecast was created by a team at the International Centre for Theoretical Physics in Trieste, Italy. The team combined data from 20 global climate simulations to demonstrate the likely consequences of climate change over the next several decades. These included flash floods around the Mediterranean and increased snowfall in northern Europe. These two areas were rated as having the highest regional climate change index, a measure of how much a region will be affected by global climate change. Eastern North America is another hotspot, where irregular weather patterns will become the order of the day by the end of the century. Why do mountain gorillas chew and swallow rotting wood, often until their gums bleed? The question has been a matter of conjecture for decades, but now biologists at Cornell University say they have the answers. The researchers observed gorillas in Uganda as they nibbled wood, and then tested the composition of what the apes preferred, as well as what they ignored. They found the chewed wood was no different to the unchewed wood, except that what they preferred had much higher levels of sodium. In fact, the researchers estimate that wood supplies the gorillas with 95% of the sodium in their diet, despite accounting for only 4% of their food intake overall. The fact that these sodium-rich stumps and logs are so highly prized explains why dominant gorillas are generally the first to have their fill. This behaviour has since been reported in a range of other primates. And finally, in ancient times, jewellers used carob seeds as weights to assess the value of precious gems. That's how one carob eventually came to be called one carat, the smallest weight for a diamond. It's long been supposed that this practice came about because of the assumption that all carob seeds are virtually identical, making them perfect as standard weights. But now it seems that assumption is false. Researchers at the University of Zurich in Switzerland collected and weighed 550 carob seeds from 28 different carob trees in Mallorca, Spain. They found the seeds were just as variable in weight as those of 63 other tree species. So, how did carob seeds come to be thought of as coming in standard size? The researchers speculate that people simply weighed carob seeds against each other to isolate the heaviest ones. To test this idea, they set up an experiment and found that subjects could perceive a difference of only 1/100th of a gram between two seeds. By choosing only the heaviest seeds, they say, an ancient jeweler could easily build up a reliable set of carob weights.
We hope you're enjoying this week's edition of SciPod, and we'd love to know what you think of our podcast. If you've got a comment or suggestion, please drop us a line. Just email your feedback to podcasts@newscientist.com. And now, back to our show.
The story of Alexander Graham Bell and the telephone is pretty well known in the annals of invention, but what's not so well known is what happened when the telephone made the leap from North America to Britain. That event was the cause of a major battle between Bell and rival inventor Thomas Edison. A battle that produced the chalk receiver, one of the most unlikely and even ridiculous telephones ever made. The story of the chalk receiver is featured this week in the Histories column of New Scientist. To find out more about it, we rang up John Liffin. He's curator of communications at the Science Museum in London.
John, can you set the stage for us? Edison and Bell were both giants of American innovation, although actually Bell was a Canadian. But how did Britain come to be the arena where these giants squared off against each other?
It was all to do with the way that Bell had patented the telephone. In other words, he'd established a priority, a legal priority, which meant that anybody else couldn't use his inventions unless they paid Bell for the privilege of doing so.
So in other words, for Edison to break into the British market, he had to get around this patent obstacle.
That's right. He had to use something, he had to achieve the same result using different methods, ones that wouldn't infringe what Bell had already protected for himself.
So as you say, he had to use something. So what was that something?
Well, he had one good invention up his sleeve, and this was a much superior microphone, or transmitter as they called it at the time. Bell's invention was very good as a receiver, the earpiece, but wasn't very efficient at all as a microphone, the transmitter, what you speak into. So you had to speak very slowly, distinctly, and quite loudly. So there was a very degraded signal that reached the earpiece. So although the earpiece worked very well, the signal actually even wasn't very good. Now, the microphone, the carbon microphone, was something which Edison was in the forefront of inventing. He wasn't its only inventor, because Professor David Hughes in Britain had invented a carbon microphone in 1878, but didn't patent it, because Hughes was one of those people who felt that invention should be given to the world. Edison wasn't like that. Edison fell upon a very similar principle, and this involves the use of carbon, in Edison's case a carbon button attached to a diaphragm resting on another diaphragm. And the principle is that if you have a loose electrical coupling between the carbon and the metal diaphragm, then pressure of air as we speak into the microphone will vary the pressure of the carbon on the metal and will vary the resistance of that circuit. So that variation is in accordance with the way we speak. So you get what was called an undulating current. Now, this carbon microphone was superior to Bell's instrument, but what Edison couldn't use, of course, was Bell's receiver. So he had to think of something else.
Right, so now Edison has this superior microphone, but how does he solve the problem of marrying it to a receiver to turn it into a full-blown telephone?
Well, he's got to reverse his undulating current and turn it back into sounds that the person at the other end can hear. And this is how he did it. And he made use of the electrolytic principle, certain chemicals which have an electrolytic action. He took a cylinder of compressed chalk and he pressed against that cylinder of compressed chalk a flat spring, which was joined to a diaphragm, and the way the spring operated, the diaphragm was pulled in a particular direction. Now, the compressed chalk was soaked with a chemical, usually potassium iodide, and the cylinder of compressed chalk was attached to a handle, a rod and a handle, so that it could be rotated by the listener. Right, now here's what's happening. Somebody is speaking down the telephone, and the signals are being received. You start turning the handle, and the spring pressing against the chalk it's a certain friction. Now, as current passes when you begin to speak, so a chemical will be formed that will reduce the friction proportionate to the amount of current coming down the line.
This sounds to me like just a remarkable invention, certainly a really unique application of that principle. So am I right in thinking then for this to work, someone has to continuously be turning the chalk?
That's absolutely right. Yes, you start turning it as soon as the call commences, and you carry on. You don't have to turn while you yourself are speaking, but as soon as you finish speaking and are ready to hear what the other person has to say, start turning again.
Yeah, so it's a great way to burn off calories, I guess. You know, if you want to hear someone speak to you, you have to just keep turning around. So what did the chalk receiver look like? Did it have a big crank on it, or how did it work?
Sort of big crank. All 19th century telephones were effectively made out of wood, you know, the wood casing, because they didn't have plastics in those days. So you've got a polished wooden box. In the middle of that wooden box, you've got the microphone, fairly straightforward. You know, you'd recognize it as a microphone if you saw it. Now, the difference is that sticking out of one side was this large metal arm, and it was hinged so that it could be folded up out of the way. It would be screwed on against the wall, this telephone, so that the earpiece on the end of it would all be folded back. And at the other end of this earpiece sticking out was a worm gear drive and a rod and a little handle, sort of a tiny sewing machine handle. And in order to receive the call, you'd obviously the bell would ring and you'd go to the telephone and you'd swing the earpiece down, it was pivoted, and start turning so that you could hear what the caller had to say.
I'm now trying to imagine a conference call with all of these people furiously turning away. So this is really a great story. So now we've got Bell with his more standard telephone. We've got Edison with the chalk receiver. How did these two competitors do in the British marketplace?
Well, fairly well, admitting that the number of subscribers to the telephone service was very small in those days, a matter of hundreds. But Edison's British company made some progress. Bell's company made some progress, but of course there was furious research activity going on. I mean, Bell needed something better than his own transmitter, and he found it. Not long after the Edison company began operations in Britain, he was able to make use of a new design of, well, carbon button microphone, but presumably sufficiently different from Edison's, called the Blake transmitter. And the Blake transmitter rather altered things because it meant there was an improved speech quality on Bell's system, which meant that the good quality earpiece, which didn't need a handle to turn it round, functioned much better. So here you are, I think it was in 1880, the two companies are going head-to-head, and there are threats of legal action against each other. It didn't actually come to court. They decided, in the end, that it would be better to join forces. And actually, this was a very good thing, because it made the telephone into a practical working device, because you now had a practical and efficient microphone and a practical and efficient earpiece, so better quality speech and easy to listen to, and the telephone really began to make progress. But Edison had done the trick.
So really it was a merger of Edison and Bell's ideas that paved the way for the telephone today.
That's right, and in fact they called the British company the United Telephone Company.
So then what became of the chalk receivers?
Well, it very quickly was consigned to museums. There was no reason to continue using it. Apart from anything else, it was high maintenance, although the development that took place over the months it was in use meant that you didn't need to get it re-soaked in chemical very often. Nevertheless, it needed frequent attention. It was just a tiresome thing to have, and who wants to carry on turning a handle while they're making a call?
Right.
They just went out of use, and most of them, I suppose, were thrown away, and some of them were kept and ended up in the museums.
So looking back now, John, do you think that, we're living in a time today where corporate giants are battling for the way we communicate with each other, telephone versus cable companies, Google versus Microsoft, all at different levels. Do these battles of the 19th century give us any insight into what's happening today with communications?
I think only that since the communications revolution began in the middle of the 19th century, actually, the devices change, but the principles don't. The principles are that everybody wants a slice of the action once something has been shown to be successful and in demand, and an awful lot of effort will be poured into getting something which is better than your competitor, or even not better than your competitor, but one which will succeed in the marketplace. Things will always happen in an unexpected way.
Well, John, at the very least, you've given us a new meaning to the expression crank call.
I hope so.
Thanks very much for your time.
And thank you too, Arden.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that wraps up this edition of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you can find in the May 6th New Scientist. Also, in this week's issue, so long, free will. A Nobel laureate physicist has developed a theory that suggests a deeper deterministic reality underlies the uncertainty of quantum mechanics. Hanging pretty. Researchers are using computers to understand how time and chemistry create stalactites and other beautiful cave formations. Interplanetary IT. Faced with more and more data from dozens of space missions, NASA is creating the equivalent of a high-speed internet in space. All of this plus lots more science and technology news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
Mission Control. SciPod transmission. Concluded.